This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the place in the metaverse between whose walls in 28 minutes you and I get to try and understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. This week, why is the city of Shanghai locked down and what could that mean for us? The Omicron variant of COVID-19 has been leading humanity a merry dance. Here in Europe, we're in the living with it phase. But in China, things are very different. The mega city of Shanghai has now been in complete lockdown for a month with no obvious end in sight. Why has this happened? And what does it mean for the rest of China and indeed the rest of the world? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First though, what are things like in Shanghai? BBC correspondent Robin Brandt is locked down in the city. Robin Brandt, tell me firstly about Shanghai. How big a city is it and what kind of city is it?
It is vast. Almost 25 million people live here. It's China's financial capital. In some ways, it's a cultural capital. It sees itself as being very different to Beijing. There's a bit of a Manchester-London thing going on there.
Some people have called it a westernised city. Is that true? And what does it mean?
I think it's westernised in the sense of its history. I mean, our office is in what's known as the former French concession. You know, you'll see a lot more foreigners here than if you just went 100 miles down the road. Plenty of Western retail outlets, although I have to say, much of Shanghai's reputation as a kind of a westernized city is because of foreign companies that have come here. Automotive is huge here, financial institutions as well.
Okay, let's come to the problems that it's been having. When did infections first start to go up?
Well, they started to appear at the end of February, but took a significant spike very much in the wrong direction at the end of March. And then since then, we've had unprecedented numbers here. Now, most of those are asymptomatic, a small number symptomatic, but you are treated exactly the same way here by the authorities who want to cart you off to centralized quarantine. So, you know, we've seen instances early on of very young babies being separated from their parents. I mean, we're going to be reporting soon on people who appear to be approaching the age of 100 taken off to quarantine centres. I mean, these can be sequestered schools, hotels. Tens of thousands of people have been taken away and you stay there until you're negative and you are released.
Rob, it was a complete lockdown, the initial response to this rise in infections.
Shanghai, if you compare it to Beijing, has been different in its approach. It's tried to stay open. There was a complacency, frankly, maybe even a hubris about the way that China overall had been victorious over the virus. That's Xi Jinping's words, not mine. In terms of the action, it was swift. It was pretty brutal in parts. I mean, we got about 3 or 4 hours notice that the lockdown was going to be put into force in the part of Shanghai that I live in. That's the Pudong, the eastern side. Those on the other side, Puxi, the western side, had 4 days notice.
Now, lockdown over here has come to mean all kinds of things, and people use it very loosely. How strict is the lockdown that you are currently undergoing in Shanghai?
This one is easy to answer, David. Chinese lockdown is not an English or a Scottish or a Welsh lockdown. The vast majority of people are confined to their house. Shops closed. There was a big issue early on with a genuine concern about getting a hold of the basics, because as part of the whole lockdown, everything shut. Distribution network for food, the availability of food. There was a real concern in the early days about literally getting the basics. Now, that changed within days, but it's still, you know, supermarkets aren't open in the sense that supermarkets where you are stayed open and there was plenty of them open.
Right. So have people had difficulty getting food and medicines and essentials?
Early on, definitely, yeah. It's about basically the logistics, the last mile supply chain of getting the food to people. Because, of course, among the groups who were locked down were those delivery drivers. It's the kind of equivalent of the gorillas or the Uber Eats where you are, and they're absolutely crucial to supply here. So everything stopped. And you're right, medicine and bartering economies we've seen on social media have emerged, particularly in compounds of people swapping food and trying to get hold of meds, a diabetes patient or stuff like that. But there isn't a lack of food, there's an inability to get it that last mile to people.
What regulations have been imposed on businesses?
Well, initially, apart from a key group of strategically important businesses like the, you know, people working at the Shanghai Stock Exchange, everything stopped.
Now, Robin, what about the scenes that we've seen a few of on the television over here, which is demonstrations in Shanghai? How's it been manifested and how widespread has it been?
Well, much of it manifests itself online. There is state-run media here and a huge infrastructure in place involving the collaboration of private companies of government to censor content, but you know, it filters through, and what we have seen is a lot of dissatisfaction about the supply of food. And as the weeks go on, not so much people questioning the overall policy, but wondering how much people have to suffer, and some people are suffering. Look, the truth is to gauge dissatisfaction is very difficult here. The other important thing to say, though, is there are lots of people who do support the policy. Particularly if you are older, and there does seem to be widespread support still for the overall policy of zero COVID.
Finally, Robin, have you got any idea when the lockdown in its current phase is going to end?
The numbers are going in the right direction. It's going to be very gradual, though. There isn't much transparency. But the one thing to remember as well is you have this arbitrary power that these neighbourhood committees and people in your street and compound have over you. They decide, really. And the truth is, there are going to be many Communist Party officials in this vast city who are going to be very, very cautious about letting people out of their compounds, because what they don't want is a case and a black mark against their name.
Robin Brandt, now I want to understand why China has felt it necessary to use extreme lockdown measures to control Omicron when other countries have long dispensed with them. Joining me are two China experts, Vincent Nee, The Guardian's China Affairs correspondent, and Professor Nancy Chen from Northwestern University in Illinois. Vincent Nee, before we look into why all this has happened, what do we know for a fact about infection rates in Shanghai and the things that we usually measure in this country, hospitalizations and deaths?
Well, we don't have enough information on hospitalization rate, but what we do know, David, is as of this week, more than 500,000 people in Shanghai, 25 million population, have been infected with Omicron, and the death rate is at around 45 deaths per 100,000 people.
Can I just ask you about the trustworthiness of those figures? Those presumably are official figures insofar as you have them. Do you think they're right?
Well, it's always very difficult to say. However, you know, we are only 1 month into this Omicron outbreak in Shanghai, so it probably takes a bit of time for the data to settle down.
Now, what do you think explains the thinking behind going into lockdown over this?
I think the reason why the authorities in Shanghai went to this length to enforce this strict lockdown is really reflective of this underlying worry that a lot of Chinese people, especially those over 60 years old, have not been fully vaccinated. Just to give you a bit of, you know, context, you know, China has a very high overall vaccination rate. It stands at around 88%. But despite this overall figure, by 5th of April, more than 92 million Chinese citizens aged 65 years old or above still had not received three doses of vaccines. And more worryingly, more than 20 million people aged 80 had not been fully vaccinated either. So this is a really, really important issue for the government.
Nancy Chen, some of these are very big figures, but actually this is rather personal for you, isn't it? Because you have elderly relatives in Shanghai. Can I just ask you first, are they vaccinated?
They are not. So I have many relatives. My family's from Shanghai, and no one over 75 has received a single shot. Another way of looking at it is 40% of people over 80 in China haven't had a single shot yet.
They've not had any.
That's right. It's really interesting because it's the opposite pattern of what we see in the US and Europe. The elderly, they almost all have two shots and even the third booster shot.
Do you have any idea why they chose not to become vaccinated?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that, you know, we have been talking about a lot, and they're all worried about side effects. And one of the reasons they're worried about the side effects is that the Chinese vaccine was originally only approved for people under 60. During the beginning of 2021, when the vaccine trials were being rolled out, the Chinese public health authorities were a little bit vague. What they literally said was that, you know, we want to roll it out for those who are the strongest, and we don't want to take any risk with the elderly population. That combined with the success of COVID zero, you know, this perception that infection rates were really low in China, gave the elderly a sense of safety. They felt like they didn't really need to get the vaccine, that it wasn't worth the potential side effects. So what happened in China, you know, it's almost as if they stumbled into an incredibly successful way of addressing COVID at the beginning of the pandemic. And now they can't get out of it because they've put too much political capital into success.
Right. So in other words, your elderly relative said the lockdown has been sufficient for us. The vaccine may not be particularly wonderful for us, so we're not going to bother. Now, Nancy, I think I read somewhere that China had actually been offering people incentives to get vaccinated. Were your relatives offered anything like that?
I think at some point they were, but this didn't really play a big role in their decision making.
Vincent.
I think it depends on, you know, which district you live, right? You know, in some areas, the authorities will offer you a basket of eggs or, you know, three chickens, you know, in order to be vaccinated. In other cases, I have heard they give 300 yuan, you know, as a means of incentive. But, you know, I think the vaccine hesitancy is a real problem in Chinese society. On top of that, David, you know, mass vaccination campaign has never been priority for the authorities in recent years.
Well,
it's not like in the UK, right? You know, every winter, you know, elderly population, you know, flu jab campaign stuff, you know, it doesn't happen in China.
But were the Chinese authorities, knowing that they had such low levels of vaccination, nervous that if there was a significant outbreak, that the Chinese health service might be put at risk?
Oh, totally, David. I think, you know, among those people who I speak to in China, they are in this really seemingly impossible situation right now. If you lift lockdown, like, you know, we have done in the UK, you know, you will see a sudden surge in infections. And in China, the healthcare system is very, very nascent. You know, just give you a figure, David, you know, the number of critical care beds per 100,000 people in China only stands at 3.6. And in the US, in comparison, it's 34.2. So that is a big difference. And that is what the Chinese authorities are most worried about.
Nancy, we see China as being one of the most authoritarian regimes on the planet. I mean, it is, after all, the country that brought in the one-child policy. Why haven't the authorities simply told people, get vaccinated, because that's your big job as a citizen?
I think there's two things to keep in mind. So China does have incredible state capacity and the ability to mobilize, you know, grassroots resources to get things done. But the one-child policy is a good example of both the power and the limitations of the power. China first rolled it out in the whole country in 1980, but it started relaxing the policy and giving exemptions as early as 1981 because of enforcement issues. And I think we're seeing something similar here play out. There's this issue just that China is very large. Different people need different things. To really effectively message, they need to take into account the cost benefits of vaccination versus alternative policies for every region. And that's a difficult task for a country that's this big.
Mm. So in other words, there was a cost element to it. It wasn't just that they didn't want to be seen to be the people who mandated vaccination. It was that actually it was tricky to afford it.
That's right. And the COVID vaccine is something that has to be reapplied again and again. So I think in the initial thinking about, does the government want to roll out the COVID vaccine? How does it want to message? Does it want people to see the vaccine as something that they're entitled to, something the government will provide every year? All of these things were a bit up in the air. These were question marks.
Can you tell me whether your relatives tell you things are changing in Shanghai? I mean, are they now beginning to go and get vaccinated now that you have the crisis there?
The irony now is that it's very difficult to get a vaccine. So as far as I know, from what I hear from my friends and relatives, is that the places that they normally go to get vaccines, they can't go anymore because of the lockdown. So that's one fact. But in terms of people's feelings about the vaccine, I haven't sensed any change. And in order to get out of this, what China really needs to do is it needs to increase trust in the vaccine, regardless of whether it wants to keep using Sinovac or adopt a new mRNA vaccine. But it really needs to increase trust in the vaccine so that the at-risk people can get vaccinated. And at the same time, it simply has to change its messaging. So the people aren't ready to live with COVID. They aren't ready to live with a certain degree of infection and a certain, although hopefully moderate, number of deaths. They've invested so much in the success of COVID zero that they haven't prepared the population at all for any degree of COVID. It simply has to change its messaging. It needs to find a way of letting the people understand that they're going to have to live with COVID, because this is just Omicron 1. The rest of the world is already dealing with Omicron 2. When Omicron 1 passes, China will have to deal with Omicron 2. So this isn't a problem that's going away.
So Nancy, I'm just wondering whether or not the imposition of a lockdown in Shanghai has some reasons other than simply efficacy in dealing with the pandemic.
I think it does. I think, you know, first and foremost, there are the issues that, you know, we've been talking about. But I think behind all of this is another discussion going on within the leadership about whether China is better off with a government that imposes things centrally versus decentrally. It's really pushed decentralization as a way to promote economic growth. You know, so the cities were competing with each other on GDP growth, and that was seen as being very successful. But together with that decentralization comes with decentralized decision making for all other things. It comes with a sense of autonomy. And we see that in Shanghai recently, when all the other cities were locking down, when infections were showing up. Shanghai said that it didn't want to lock down. It wanted to implement and test a more gradual approach. And the central government allowed it to do so, maybe because it was interested to see if it would work, maybe because Shanghai is, you know, the largest economy and, you know, a very powerful city. But then after the four-day half-city lockdowns, all of a sudden, the central government forced Shanghai to lock down completely. And so many see this, a statement from the central government saying that the decentralized approach doesn't work. We need to go back to a centralized approach.
So, Vincent, is that one reason why Shanghai was so chaotic at the start of this latest outbreak, which was that it just simply didn't expect to be locked down, and then it was?
Well, the local Shanghai government was, you know, quite half-hearted. And, you know, what's really shocking thing to a lot of Shanghainese people is that there is no end in sight. Right, they went into a full city lockdown on April the 1st, essentially. And then, you know, nobody knows when the lockdowns will be lifted.
Nancy, is there any sympathy for Shanghai from the rest of the country? Is the rest of China saying, oh dear, that's terrible what's happening to Shanghai, how can we help?
So on Chinese social media, I've seen posts that put the entire blame on Shanghai, that Shanghai should have not deviated from zero COVID policies from the beginning, and they really shouldn't complain. And then you also see other types of posts, right, which they say, well, you know, these poor people, whatever the cause, you know, what they're going through is very tough. You know, we should support them. So it's a bit of a mixed bag.
Vincent, is Shanghai popular amongst Chinese generally? I mean, I speak as a Londoner who is sometimes aware that a powerful city doesn't always recommend itself to people who don't live in it.
Well, I mean, David, if you think about, you know, how French people see English people, right, and the vice versa, you know, when I was growing up in Shanghai in the 90s, you know, we didn't even bother speaking Mandarin because, you know, Shanghainese was the language. You know, we were like, you know, the French of Europe. You only stick to our own language. Regional chauvinism really also factors into how people outside of Shanghai perceive this lockdown. You know, like Nancy said, some people blame it's all Shanghainese fault because you guys are too well-fed, too spoiled, too arrogant, right? So there's a sense of a schadenfreude. But I also observed...
What is the Chinese for schadenfreude?
幸灾乐祸. Nancy, do you agree?
Yes, absolutely.
Schadenfreude. Anyway, what I wanted to say, David, is that what I have observed in the last few weeks is that, you know, because of censorship, a lot of people outside of Shanghai, especially those, you know, far, you know, up north, they might not necessarily understand what really is going on in Shanghai. So what I worry is that local officials in those cities might not necessarily be able to learn the lessons from Shanghai. And that might be the biggest worry, as Omicron seems to be sweeping across many parts of Asia.
That was Vincent Ni with Nancy Chen. Finally, when it comes to the effects of the pandemic, no man is an island. So what impact is the Shanghai lockdown having in China and globally? George Magnus is an economist and research associate at Oxford University's China Centre. And Dr. Yu Jia is a senior research fellow on China in the Asia-Pacific programme at Chatham House. Yu Jia, firstly, let's talk about the port of Shanghai. How important is Shanghai to international trade?
Well, it is massively important. The Shanghai port is the world's largest container ship. And then considering China being both an export powerhouse and also China being a good, strong importer, Shanghai port is pretty much vital for China's economic flows. And so given what is happening with the lockdown in Shanghai, the port seems to me almost become paralyzed. It seems to me that 90% of the containers are waiting to be loaded and unloaded. So it is in a very tricky situation. The goods that need to be sent around the country, around the world, got delayed. And also the goods that the country needed from China and also got delayed. So that really added extra issue for the long-standing supply chain issue we have seen in COVID. So let's wait and see what happens.
Right. George Magnus, how important as a manufacturing base in itself is Shanghai?
Oh, the Shanghai, narrowly defined district of Shanghai, as the city, is about 4% of China's GDP. If you kind of broaden it out to the region, it's probably double that. It's got semiconductors, electronics, communications, chemicals. There's a special economic zone in Shanghai, which has attracted, of course, a lot of financial firms. There are about 50,000 businesses registered in Shanghai city. And obviously, it's the headquarters or regional headquarters, certainly for a lot of foreign firms. So, yeah, pretty important.
George, there have been business closures as a result of the lockdown. We know that. What impact will these have been having on us and other countries? Have we felt the full impact yet, or is it to come?
I don't think we have, in the sense. So a lot of the kind of ships, for example, that are arriving in European ports at the moment or recently, they left, you know, long before the lockdowns actually began in Shanghai. So we probably won't see an impact from this until, let's say, later this spring and early summer. And then we might expect to see shortages of things like electronics goods, pharmaceutical materials, machine parts, and so on. So there will be effects on the availability of products that haven't actually gotten out of Shanghai. And shipping and freight costs have rocketed for lots of different reasons, including, of course, you know, the war in Ukraine. But for Shanghai, the difficulties of getting stuff out means that prices for freight have probably doubled or trebled in the last several weeks. So this will add to cost as well. So unfortunately, it's lower volume of products and higher prices.
And the increased price of freight presumably feeds through to the prices eventually that we all pay.
Exactly. So, I mean, obviously, shippers have an option basically to absorb the cost, but, you know, one imagines they will be very keen to pass it on if they can.
Yujia, what do we know about the impact the lockdown is having on the Chinese economy?
Well, it is extremely worrying. I mean, we have just seen the first quarter economic data. I think that's well below what the Chinese government has set up the target, 5.5 this year. President Xi was much hoping that it will be a very smooth sailing until the 20th Party Congress and to have a reasonable economic performance. But given the lockdown in Shanghai and also given the current war in Ukraine added together, it seems to be that the stability President Xi wanted for this year are very unlikely to achieve.
So in other words, he wants to be able to go to the 20th Party Congress and to be able to say things are going really well and this is going to make it more difficult.
Well, he wanted to bask himself in glory that he has produced prosperity for the population for all. But unfortunately, what he has bring so far, it seems to be a lot of miseries within Shanghai.
George Magnus, how did you see the development of the Chinese economy in the period before this lockdown?
I don't think it was great. I mean, the property market, for example, has been kind of wobbly for quite a few months now. And although the sales of houses and apartments had sort of stabilized a bit in January and February, it looked pretty tenuous. And I think this will probably obviously have made it worse. The export sector of China had been reasonably good, but because of developments in the world and Ukraine and so on, I mean, global demand is expected to kind of slacken. Consumption in China has been really disappointing. And this is really only on the basis of data that we have through March, which is before the real impact of the Shanghai lockdowns. And the index of service-producing activities in China, like hospitality, transportation, leisure, recorded its worst sentiment index in March since the original COVID crisis in January of 2020. And in some ways, there's a suspicion that, well, obviously, the longer these things go on, you know, the worse it will become. So the economy, I think, was pretty enfeebled. You know, the government in China wanted to make this year a year of stability. And I think really all they have to show for it really is instability.
Yujia, George was talking there about problems in consumption. Usually, we associate problems in consumption with a lack of confidence of the people in their immediate economic and financial future. Is that the case in China?
Well, that surely would apply for the case of China. I mean, George was talking about the leisure sector, tourism sector. Because of all these restrictions has been imposed, and it really gives consumers very little confidence to consume. Because what they worry about is once they go to one province, in case if that province had locked down, and it's very hard for them to return and back to work normally. So that worry has really playing around across the population. So consumer mood is very damp at the moment in China.
George, that would certainly suggest that if there were a trade-off, let's say, between having a COVID zero strategy and an opening up strategy, that it would be very much in the interests of the ruling party to open up. Will they do that? And if they won't, why?
Well, there are lots of things conflated in China's kind of COVID management policy. I mean, public health obviously is an issue, but it's also about politics, I think. And the Communist Party of China, particularly President Xi Jinping, cannot really afford to back away from a policy with which he is personally associated, in my view. I mean, I think it would look at least a public relations disaster, if not something worse, particularly in these months leading up to the 20th Party Congress at the end of the year. So I think in principle, the idea of commitment to zero COVID is going to endure at least through the end of this year and perhaps even into 2023.
Yujia, is that the way you see it too?
Well, that's the way I see it, but I think for different reasons. There's a one psychological factor which we haven't covered in here is that the Chinese population has the expectation that zero COVID society does exist, because in the past 2 years, that's essentially the policy of China. Now, secondly, what we haven't covered in here is that 1.4 billion population, to have public hospitals, 30,000, is a staggering small number. And also the ICU occupation, the ICU beds in China, on average, is lower than Bulgaria. So the health authority can't afford just to fully open up, even though you have the economic argument for that. But at the end of the day, I think it's also come to this ideas of fear, the fear of COVID that both government and the population fear about.
So that's a really sharp dilemma for the Chinese government, is what you're saying.
Absolutely, yeah.
That was Yu Jie with George Magnus. My thanks to them and to Robin Brandt, Nancy Chen and Vincent Nee. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirstine Knight, Ben Carter and Rosamund Jones. The programme was mixed by Neil Churchill. The editor was Richard Barden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again very soon. And if you enjoyed it, you can find many others on BBC Sounds.
I thought it was going to be like, we have such a great friendship that we can talk about things that I can't talk about with anyone else, even my wife.
I can talk to you about things that I can't talk to my wife about, because when I try to talk to my wife about work, she just rolls her eyes.
I thought you were going to say, like, we're like astronauts, we're the only ones who've been to the moon and no one else has seen what we've seen. I'm Louis Theroux, and if, like me, you enjoyed listening to John Ronson's Things Fell Apart podcast, you might also like this conversation where I ask him all about how he made it.
Funny, so you're conflict averse, I'm conflict averse, yet we spend our lives putting ourselves in very conflict-heavy situations. Why is that, Louis?
That's How Things Fell Apart with John Ronson and Louis Theroux on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hello. It's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4, History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.